Looking to stand out from the pack at your first job? When you earn a master's in management from Georgetown, you'll gain the skills employers value most, elevating your career prospects for years to come. Get started at choosegeorgetown.com/MIM.
It's the Smart Driving Cars podcast. I'm Fred Fishkin, along with the faculty chair of autonomous vehicle engineering at Princeton University, Alan Kornhauser. Hi, Alan.
Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. And from Sweden, we're happy to have with us again Michael Senna, well-known expert and publisher of the Dispatcher newsletter. Thanks for being here with us, Michael.
Always a pleasure, Fred. Thank you.
Great having you.
Well, let's start out with the latest edition of the Dispatcher. Very worthwhile reading again, Michael, and you put an awful lot of work into it. The lead article is Ready or Not, Here Comes the Waymo Taxi Robot. A great look at where Google has been with Waymo and where it is going. Tell us about some of the key takeaways here.
Well, the main reason I wrote the article, Fred, was that there's been an awful lot of speculation over the years that Google and now Waymo have been active in this area. They've got a long history. They have been at it for, I don't know, maybe 6-7 years. And we've gone from seeing their little Fiat Cinquecento type automobile to now having them saying, we're going live. We're going to start taking riders. And with all the speculation, I just thought it would be good to put out a view, my view, that they are in this and they're going to be running a business and they're going to be taking lots of data. And this fits right in with Alphabet, Google's business plan. It's part of their strategy. 86% of the income for Alphabet comes from ads. And this is just another way of getting ad income and supporting the business.
Describe for us a little bit more about how that business model is going to work. For people who are wondering, why is Google doing this?
Right. I put a few diagrams in here. One diagram shows the Google advertising model. It's important to keep in mind that we, users of their search, primarily their search engine and other types of activities, we're users. We're not their customers. Their customers are the people who pay the money. We get most of the things that we get are free, although when we do buy things, we also are providing them with lots of data. So as a user, we get something, search or some other form of service, and we provide them with lots of data, which Google then processes and sells in different ways to their real customers, who are the businesses. If you apply the same model to the Waymo taxi, the ride user is going to pay something. We're not really sure what the ride user is going to pay. They're still working out how much it's going to be. But in any case, they'll need to be undercutting other services because basically the person who's going to be doing this isn't in this for the excitement. Maybe initially, but in the end, they just want to get from one place to the other. And it's going to depend on money. So they'll pay something, maybe. But Waymo is going to be providing the OEM with something, the car OEM. So in this case, the first ones out will be the Chrysler Pacificas. Google will most likely pay the OEM something when someone clicks on an ad in those vehicles, and they'll have nice big screens where they can have the possibility to do all kinds of things, surfing on the net. But the basic business model is exactly the same. Google will be providing data and getting money from their business customers, and the ride user, instead of the search user, the ride user will be providing money for the possibility for Google to continue to support that business model by providing data. So it's an extension of the current business model that Google has and has had since it figured out what it was going to be doing with its life.
Do you think consumers should be wary, concerned about any privacy issues once they add this into the overall Google mix?
I wouldn't get in one of those taxis, but I don't use Google. You know, of course they should. Of course, I don't have Facebook. I don't have Twitter. I don't do all of those things because
me neither. Okay, so but I'll get it. But go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, they should be, but they won't be. I mean, they don't. Most people don't really care. They get a free search. They get, you know, whatever they get for free, and Google makes lots of money. So, you know, everybody seems to be happy with that approach. I think it's going to be difficult for them to do this a similar sort of service in Europe, but we'll see.
It of course Google has the advertising model and the advertising model it's just worked enormously well, and I think it's worked well for certainly worked extremely well with Facebook, which is just a shock to me, but that's a whole other story, because I don't think a slightly different way, and not to debate this, but slightly different way to look at it, that the advertising model is a connection model. I mean, I think, in fact, if you look at Facebook, Amazon, Google, in some sense, their connection model, and the model that Amazon sort of originally put out there is the connection for the needle in a haystack to find the other needle in the haystack. It's not only for one to find a needle in a haystack, it's for the needle in a haystack to find a needle in a haystack. I mean, that's what the whole book business, rare book business, or out of print book business was all about. It's to be able to do that. In some sense, that's what search is. Search is, you're looking for something, and it's usually a needle in a haystack. And that's what makes it tough. Otherwise, it'd be easy to find. You wouldn't bother. The connection with advertising is that I want something and I don't know where to get it. I don't know how to get it. So put the information out there and somehow somebody finds what I need. Part of the problem is that it's not what I really want. It's what somebody else convinces me that I want, that tells me that makes the whole thing and then problematic. That's when it becomes propaganda, and the propaganda piece of it then of course really gets us. Oh my goodness. You start using that word, or at least maybe because of my age, the word propaganda sends chills up and down my spine, because I guess the information system when I grew up told me propaganda is wrong because the Ruskies are doing it or something like that. I don't know. But in some sense, that's what it is. And when you look at what Waymo actually does is in providing that connection, it connects us with where we might want to go. So, that's looking at it in a positive way. Your comment with respect to knowing what's or your privacy, I think Facebook tries to tell us we don't have any privacy. We don't have any privacy. There's no doubt there's going to be an enormous pipe in there. If you just look at what the Waymo just released with respect to their dealing with public safety in case something happens and sort of emergency response. And if the thing should break down, I mean, they make it clear they have a pipe in there to be able to know what's going on, put the windows down, communicate with the police, and so on and so forth. And of course, I guess we would want it in an elevator, I kiss my wife every once in a while in an elevator, and then, oh my goodness, the guy downstairs or the gal downstairs at the desk, oh Jesus, there are cameras in there. And, mm-hmm. of course there's going to be, and in some sense we would want it to be, because certainly if we have it in a shared ride context, which I think is the only context this ends up making any sense, where we can share rides when we can, then in fact to sort of encourage everybody in there to behave, somebody somewhere is going to need to know what the hell's going on. And so again, we're between the rock and the hard place associated with those things. And I guess there's nothing that's perfect. With every benefit, there's a disbenefit. So everything's a trade-off. I don't know. Go ahead, Michael. Chime in here.
Well, I think there's a big difference between Google, Alphabet Google business plan and or business model and Amazon. But I think that the basic idea that, yes, there will be a great opportunity for Waymo to support Alphabet to generate ad income, but the main question is why are they doing this other than having another way of supporting the main company? I mean, why are they doing this with self-driving cars or driverless cars? Why don't they just take over Uber and do the same thing with drivers? And I think that's the bigger question. And I'll take that up in another issue of the Dispatcher. Here, I was just trying to, to put some context on what it is and how they're approaching this business. But the other thing about this is that in the same way that they closed down their social media, if it turns out that they're not generating enough income and they are spending too much money, and the latest information on their quarterly report indicates that they're putting a lot of money into businesses, and this is affecting their margin, they could just drop this like they've dropped other things in the past. It's not their main business. If 86% of their revenue is coming from advertising, that's their main business. It's not being in the taxi business, which is whether it's a person driving the taxi or a robot driving the taxi. It's. I think we have to look at it in that way. So, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, I agree. They could drop it. It's I'm a fan simply because what. The difference between them and Uber, Lyft, or Didi is that they have the opportunity for scale, and the other piece of it, which is sort of an interesting piece that I've been sort of talking with others about, is that the provision of the mobility using a computer should be able to deliver a much higher quality of service to more people, because you have less of a game system. By game system, games are where entities are basically competing and cooperating, each with their own objectives, sort of in the John Nash concept of game theory. And part of the problem with respect to Uber and Lyft is not only do they have to would they like to optimize or do the best level of service to a user, they have to operate that thing so that it generates enough revenue for the driver to maximize his or her objective on that. And so there, at times, there's a competition with respect to that. Maybe drivers don't like to provide the service to multiple people in their car, or they don't want to go there and pick somebody up, or they don't want to take them there, or this kind of thing. And some, or they want to go home, or they don't want to work, or there's that their objective that needs to be dealt with. Now, of course, if you have a computer doing it, I'm sure Michael will say, well, the entity that controls that algorithm wants to maximize the amount of money they want to make out of all this. And of course, sure. and so you don't get away from the problem that I've just posed, and it might even exacerbate it, but it might also enable an easier way to have a public oversight and do regulation, because then it's easier to say, hey, you should be tweaking your algorithm this way to then deliver more public benefits out of this, whereas otherwise I have to go out there and herd all those cats, as I like to call them, that perform that service, all the gig workers, and my goodness, the effort that I have to go through to get them to do what I might want them to do for good or bad reasons is just enormously difficult, as opposed to on the other way, all I need to do is change a couple lines of code and I can achieve it. And a regulator can look over that and say, hey, here's the data, here's the thing, this thing should be working this way. Again, if the regulator is working appropriately, so and it's much more transparent because, you know, it's data and algorithms. I don't know, but that's the argument on the other side of the ledger.
If we just go look at just the taxi business at the end of the Waymo piece, I spent a little bit of space talking about why the taxi business ruined itself. It didn't have to. I mean, I took taxis in London when it was just the black taxis. I took taxis in Stockholm when it was just...
Yeah, me too.
Just, you know, and those, they provided you with a service. They knew where they were going.
They're professional.
Professionals. I don't take Uber. I don't use those services. When I get into a taxi in Stockholm, there are four or five different companies. I tell them, I'm going to go in Stockholm taxi. If you want to put me in another taxi, I'm going to wait here until a Stockholm taxi comes. That's the end of it. I'm not taking another taxi. You know, so I think at a certain point in time, we've decided that what's important for us is the absolute lowest price. And it's not service. It's not privacy. It's not all of these other things. It's getting, you know, rushing to the bottom with price. But in the end, you end up paying more. And I think this is one thing that we have to be very careful with as we try to provide more and more different types of services that help people do things. In the end, people are going to start turning around and saying, like they are with scooters in places like New York and Stockholm, do we really want these things with, you know, either adults or young adults or young people riding in traffic? We spent so much money making our cars impregnable so that people don't die when we're in there, and then we throw people out on the street with scooters and no helmets and they're in the middle of traffic or with electric bicycles, you know.
I don't get me on that one, because that I you know, holy, that is just that is such a quagmire. I mean, it's now you're intruding in my walk space. I mean, come on. That's I'm not going to put up with that. As you go by, I'm just going to push you a little bit, and then you'll go unstable into the doom. Oh, my goodness. Oh, it's just whatever.
While we're on the subject of accidents, Alan, you already alluded to it, but Waymo is out with that 36-page guide for emergency responders and law enforcement. You've had more of a chance to look at it now?
Yeah, no, I've looked at it, and I think what struck me with that, okay, what struck me with that is the extent to which one needs the support services and overhead, let's call it, to provide this driverless service business. Okay, and one of the things that I did in my testimony before the two committees at the New Jersey State Assembly last Monday is part of my testimony, I even suggested that maybe what we need is some legislation, regulation, at least in the beginning forbids manufacturers from selling driverless vehicles to us, the public. Because in a sense, if we're going to do this, okay, and if we're going to say, okay, we're going to put up with the privacy, we're going to put up with the, in some sense, the business model, the fact that we are paying and so on and so forth for using of this thing, these things, when they go out there, if they are going to work, they are going to need such a support mechanism to enable them to work safely that us as individuals are unable to deliver with it. You know, once I was driving to JFK, and of course I was misbehaving or something, and I hit a curb, and I got a flat tire on the Belt Parkway, and I had to pull over on the grass, and so I changed the tire. I change the tire. I mean, if that's going to happen with a driverless vehicle, of course, a tow truck is going to have to come there and change the tire. And it will happen. Of course, it will happen. But I was there to do it. Unfortunately, I got back in the car and went back out on the Belt Parkway and realized, oh, my goodness, I blew two tires. And so therefore, then I was, you know, needed the tow truck. Never made, I was going to Sweden to, didn't make that airplane. But
you're going to pick up your Nobel Prize.
Yeah, right. But there's just an enormous amount of support that's going to have to be there. And if we were to own these things, and all of a sudden I dispatch mine to JFK to pick up Michael, who's coming in on a flight, and that thing is going there all by itself, and something happens, and here I'm sitting here, you know, in the lap of luxury in Princeton. What am I going to do about it? You know, yeah, of course, call AAA, but I mean, it's just. You know, there's no, I'm not there to talk to the guy, at least when the guy came and, you know, flatbedded me after I, whatever, that's a whole other story. You know, I was there to ride in the truck and follow and sort of stay with my car. There's just an enormous amount of overhead of support that needs to be, and it almost has to be in a fleet context. You almost can't put these things out unless they are. Otherwise, I mean, these things are just going to be strewn around like all those electric scooters. Or now, hey, I'm done with it. Boom, I drop it here, and then you know, what do I care? I'm not done. I'm finished with the elevator. It's taken me to the 20th floor. I'm going to my room. I don't care what happens to that elevator. I don't care what happens to that scooter. I don't care what happens to that driverless car. It's now out of my life. Somebody's got to care. And so it's not going to be that simple. And so you've got to do that. That's what I took from that. And, of course, in a sense, also the amount of, you know, really thought. I thought that a lot of thought went into it. And of course, Waymo's put in the thought. I mean, they've at least done this very seriously. I guess we'll talk about Elon saying, "Hey, you know, I'm going to go do this too." But we'll talk about that later.
We'll get there. Actually, Michael, in the dispatcher, you talk about Tesla Inc., which you label the most misunderstood car company.
Again, my point was to try to put some clarity around what I've been criticizing the company for. It hasn't been for its approach to business. It hasn't been for its approach to how it builds cars and has built its company. I've criticized it primarily because of Autopilot and the irresponsible nature that. Or the way that they put that out on the streets without really testing it. But what I wanted to do in this article was to look at the company and why its valuation is so out of proportion to its sales and its profitability. It just announced this week that it had its first profit in a couple of years, and the likelihood that it's going to be able to continue in a profitable way is very small because of the high cost that it has. But looking at the company, what is it that the company is doing differently from all of the other car OEMs? And that's what I wanted to put into this article, and I hope that I hope from the feedback I've gotten from my readers, particularly those working in car companies, they seem to say, well, yeah, this is not your regular car company. It's not GM. It's not even Toyota. They've done something that is completely different from what other companies have done since Henry Ford had a vertically integrated company where he had the steel mines, he had the coal coal mines to create the steel, he had the rubber, and he built cars. We've gone in a completely different direction since then, and Tesla's brought us all back. And they are vertically integrated in so many different ways that they're gaining value out of every single piece of the car sales and production process. And even more importantly, they're in a position of collecting the kind of data that other companies are having a great deal of difficulty doing because of the way that the cars are built and the way the cars are maintained. So,
well, Michael, I think that that's why this dispatcher, well, the other dispatchers have been great too, but this is so good because, in fact, I think you hit on an enormously valuable point. I mean, it's amazing how much Henry Ford vertically integrated Ford. I mean, it's not only the things you mentioned, he even had a cinema company in which he basically created, I'll call it propaganda, but whatever, about how one needed roads to get farm to market and so on. And that was directly integrated with creating somebody else paying for an infrastructure so that his cars would have some place to operate. And so absolutely, but you've of course hit the nail on the head on this. The vertical integration of Tesla with respect to, again, it's data and information, and not only that, I guess it's customer care. Well, I'll put a positive spin on it. It's customer care. Look, GM created OnStar to connect to the customer, and Mercedes had whatever they called it, and
Grace.
Embrace and so on. And everybody talked 10, 15, 20 years ago about, they were trying to get back into the car phone business. They thought they owned the car phone. That's why it's called car phone. And at least still probably called that in England, because of course you needed a big battery and a big place to handle, someplace to put the darn thing. You couldn't have a small car because the phone was bigger than the car, but no, that's whatever. But and they had that at one point, and of course lost it almost instantaneously and been trying to regain it. And maybe they wanted to regain it to have information. I don't know. I think they wanted to regain it to, get paid for the minutes or something like that, but maybe they had better insight. I don't know than that, but it seems to me you've hit the nail absolutely on the head that here Tesla, they do it for the information, the amount of information that they gather continuously on not only the operation of their system so that they know exactly what's working, what's not working, and so, but the ability to then take that and feed it back to you and improve it. Maybe they're improving it for their own bottom line as opposed to my bottom line as a potential owner, but it's amazing. I've written a couple of times, in 2014, I bought an S-Class with all the 997 package and all this stuff. Mercedes, except for spamming me with emails in a conventional way, has never gone back and try to contact me in the car or even improve the car. And damn it, you know, their Distronic Plus, their lane centering system doesn't work well at all. The intelligent cruise control with respect to if I tap the brakes, turns the damn thing off as opposed to just the acceleration function, doesn't work. But they've never fixed it. They've never upgraded it. They've never made any attempt. And it's just depressing. Whereas, what the heck has Tesla done? I mean, they update it, I don't know, every night, I don't know, something like that. And they know exactly what's going on. And they have the opportunity to do it. They have the opportunity to screw us just as well as to help us if they should choose so. And that's, of course, the enormous danger. But the business of vertically integrating it, not only in the manufacturing, not only in the sales process, but now in the continuing ownership process, where in some sense it almost makes Tesla look like they're going to upgrade the thing that you bought in the past and continue to make it better, as opposed to saying, okay, sucker, you bought it, you want a better one, go back to the showroom and trade it in and buy a new one. I mean, wow. Michael, jump in.
No, exactly. The other approach on this, there isn't another car company that's even close to doing what Tesla has done. Well, Elon Musk, who I've had major difficulties with this company.
Yes.
He does seem to be a loose cannon. But the one thing he did say when he was giving his explanation of the latest results of the company, he said, we've had problems delivering our cars. We know that, and we know why they're having problems delivering their cars. He says, we had problems delivering their cars. We had customers calling us, volunteering to help us deliver our cars in certain markets. How can we possibly thank those people, he said, something to that nature. And the reason that people do that is because they know they've got something that's very special. It may not, in some cases, it acts like a toy. It acts like a computer. And yes, it doesn't always, when you update, it doesn't always work properly. It isn't the most, in my terms, it isn't the most beautiful car. It isn't the most well-made car. But putting it all together, it adds up to something that's much more than pretty much any other car that's on the market. And what I say in the last page of the article, if you want to do something about this, start thinking about doing it, starting from scratch. You know, don't just build another car that's based on the same architecture, the same design, the same concept as we've been doing for the last 20, 25 years since we went to drive-by-wire. Start doing it the right way. Build it from scratch, but look at what Tesla's done and try to learn something from it. That's my recommendation.
Well, I mean, you point on another thing that this... When I had ALK and we developed Copilot, the turn-by-turn navigation system, you know, one of the things that we did in the very beginning of that is that the system would cache the GPS data that it used to do what it did, and the reason we did that is so that we could if there was a problem with it, the customer could send us the data so we could try to figure out what the heck happened. And with the data you couldn't do anything. But what the data was really valuable to us for was to improve the map, underlying digital map database that all this was based on, and that's why we stored the information, and that's what we were intending to use it for. And this data was just so valuable that basically the customer was just out there collecting it, not even knowing in some sense that they were collecting it, sort of the crowdsourcing business. Mm-hmm. And then what amazed me about the process was, even if the customer wasn't having a problem, just getting an email from me saying, look, this is what we're doing this with the data. What we use the data for is to improve the map database so that, in fact, the next version can be better. Please send us your data. And it was amazing the number of people who just wanted to help out. Who would? I had a minister in Delaware. You know, he went out and we had his all the data in his neighborhood and where he lived all wrong. He went out and just drove it, so collecting the data and sent it to us. It just amazed me how much if you tell the customer that you want to use it to help that to help make the product better, how many of them want to come out and just help you make it better. And I think that's kind of also the esprit de corps that Elon's been able to generate out of his customers. I think all that stuff can really be misused. But when he puts out some information saying that in fact the cars that are driven, his cars that are driven without autopilot crash at this rate, whereas the cars that have autopilot crash at that rate. I mean, this is just data. Now, it may not be that they've driven the same miles and the miles driven without autopilot are much more difficult miles to drive than the miles with autopilot. And therefore, of course, the crash rates should be lower and blah, blah, blah. And autopilot doesn't have anything to do with making it, crash less and so on. But at least the data for one that can do an objective look or from Tesla's point of view, say, hey, how do we fix the problem? How do we make a night better? Now, maybe what they should do, or maybe what GM should allow them to do, is say, hey, whatever IP we have on the system that we put in a Cadillac CT6 that says that sits there and monitors you and make sure that you're behaving, and if you misbehave, then we'll just pull over and turn off autopilot, and until you agree to behave, then you stand in the corner with your dunce cap on, and so on. To make it better, but the ability to fully vertically integrate now the customer through the customer experience and the lifetime of the product, you know, basically almost from design through you know, from birth from conception to interment, of the product is as you point out, Michael, just phenomenal.
A different kind of customer experience. Alan, you're also talking, though, about Musk's comments during that earnings call that the company will obviously be taking on Uber and Lyft with a self-driving ride-hailing service. You're pretty skeptical.
Well, again, this is where Elon's going, loose on the deck again. Autopilot is not prepared to do driverless. It can't take me from point A to point B completely. You know, as I crawl out of the watering hole, it's not going to drop me off in my doorstep so I can crawl into my bed. Okay, so it's not there, or at least they haven't provided the information to suggest that it is there. So, I haven't seen it. And to think that they're going to do that and be able to compete with what a Lyft driver does, or what a Uber or a Didi driver does, or what a taxi driver does, or a stock on it, is just, I don't know. And it's not an easy step. I mean, you've got to go through and put together the entourage with respect to emergency preparedness that Waymo just put out and so on. So I don't know. That's my comment on that one. Michael?
It's a different business model. Tesla's in the business of getting – squeezing every penny out of the money that they're putting into their vehicles. Everything from delivering energy to delivering information. It's just a completely different business model than Waymo, or with their connection to Alphabet, or Uber and Lyft as essentially platforms for connecting people with a ride. And it's, they don't have to do that. They're going to be, their sales are increasing. If you look at the sales, the quarterly sales or monthly sales now in the United States, they've already passed Jaguar, Land Rover. They're going to be passing Volvo very quickly on a monthly basis. Their sales are increasing, and the more they sell, the more money they'll be able to squeeze out of everything that they do. So they don't need to be in the business.
Yeah, and besides their sales, I think if you go to the EV electric vehicle reports and sales report, and you look at the monthly sales over the years, let's say sales in July for the past 5 years of electric vehicles, what you see in this past July is that there's an enormous rise in sales in August and September and October and so on. It's because the Model 3 line is finally out there. They're more than half of the electric vehicle sales in the U.S. and of all the other competitors, including the S and the SUV of Tesla, the Model 3 has 50% of the market, and they are it could very well be a juggernaut out there, and in a sense. I guess, Elon's pulled the rabbit out of the hat. I don't know what the short sellers are doing now.
Let me ask you this, Michael. In the Dispatcher, you mentioned this Wyoming senator's efforts to end subsidies, the rebates for electronic vehicles altogether. Would that put a damper on all this?
Yeah. That's the other side of this coin. That little piece Senator Barrasso, and he's totally right. I mean, if the fuel tax is paying for roads and to a certain extent paying for subsidies to transit, there's no money coming out of electric vehicles that's going into that. Unless it's a hybrid or a plug-in hybrid, where they're buying some fuel, but if for a battery electric vehicle, there's no money coming out of that vehicle that's supporting the infrastructure. So they've been getting a free ride. There are a number of things that could eventually put a damper on the growth of Tesla, which is a purely electric vehicle, or on electric vehicles in general, and that this is one of them. The other one I mentioned in the other article on the UN report, the United Nations Climate Panel report, where the more electric vehicles we put out there, the more electricity we need, and the more electricity we need, the more harmful emissions we're putting out into the atmosphere, because most of our electricity in the world today is being produced using coal. We're not going to discuss that particular article in this discussion, because we just don't have enough time.
Come on, you open the door. We got to, whatever. Go ahead.
I think this is one of the most difficult issues that we have to address. People are pushing, trying to push electric vehicles without looking at the real problem that we're creating. It's not just electric cars, but battery bicycles and scooters and more electrification. While at the same time, we've got China producing 30% of the harmful emissions going out into the atmosphere. 30%. And most of their electricity is generated with coal. Yeah, we have countries, at least in the United States, where our emissions are now 15%. We were much higher. A lot of our energy, some states are higher, some states are lower, but in general, we're using much more nuclear energy, which the Greens will, environmentalists would say, you know, that's the worst possible problem that we have. But what's worse is that creating more and more harmful emissions through the generation of electricity, and the more electricity we need, the more harmful emissions go out there, or is it closing nuclear power plants in Germany and in Sweden, because we feel that these power plants are harmful for the environment. There's a very big disconnect between what policymakers are trying to do with electric vehicles in general and what they're doing about climate policy. And somehow that these issues have to be connected to one another. Right now they're not.
Well, Michael, you're absolutely right. I mean, if you're looking at energy, and energy is the environmental or pollution problem, therefore what you want to do is you want to find out, you know, what's the most sensitive, what's going to give you the biggest bang for the buck in terms of the buck you're trying to deal with. The buck here is environment. The biggest bang for the buck is, let's call it coal. I don't know if it's nuclear, but I don't want to argue about it, but let's call it coal. So therefore, you know, you get the most out of reducing coal. Great, fine, let's reduce coal, but we reduce coal, we reduce energy, electricity. But you say on the other end, oh my goodness, we want to consume more electricity. Okay, so now we're going to consume more electricity. Let's see if in that consumption, that electricity, what are we not consuming if we consume that electricity? Well, it's called petroleum. How efficiently is that petroleum being used now versus producing that same thing with electricity? So let's look at the trade-off between petroleum and coal, because if I move it from petroleum, I'm going to move it to electricity. Electricity is going to mean that I won't be able to cut down the coal as much. And, you know, it says, okay, well, is the petroleum worse than the coal? And I think everybody agrees, at least the way petroleum is used in internal combustion engines today and might even be used tomorrow in tomorrow's internal combustion engine, that it's being used better than coal. So, my goodness, we're moving electricity, which means it's going to really decrease petroleum but increase coal. We're going backwards.
Right, exactly.
You know, I mean, go ahead.
I have a note here from one of my good friends in the car industry. He says, I'm translating now, it's in another language, but he says, when it concerns CO2, I agree with you. The best solution is a diesel engine with HVO, hydrogen.
Yeah.
Diesel bio HVO. So instead of petroleum based diesel, it's vegetation based diesel. So the point is, what are we trying to accomplish? Are we trying to with electric vehicles? I mean, there's no magic with electric vehicles. An electric vehicle, yes, it's got a lot of torque, and it's got a lot of, you know, speed, and it's quiet. That could be a problem, but it's cleaner from a number of standpoints. But if we're really trying to improve the environment, electric vehicle isn't the answer. The answer is looking for ways of reducing the amount of harmful emissions. And it's not just the emissions coming out of the car; it's the emissions that are going into producing the energy that eventually is used in the car. And that's where I'd like to see much more focus.
Really, an interesting discussion. Yeah,
and in fact, if you take that even to where I want, or where I argue and take it, is that if we really want to do this, we should be looking at moving people, because that's where we get any societal benefit is in the quality of life improvement. Apparently, that's the only reason why people move. The only reason you go from A to B is because you're going to increase your personal utility. Otherwise, you'd stay at home in your parents' basement and play video games or something. I don't know. But You know, if that's it. But what we need to do is basically share rides. And in some places in Manhattan, you can share a ride in the subway, and other places you can share a ride in the bus. But in many other places, you could share a ride in your car, which I know Michael doesn't like it because he likes to drive his own car. But you know, sharing rides is to me, if you're an environmentalist, you can't be against that.
Well, finally, there's been quite a bit of press this week about an MIT survey on the moral choices autonomous systems may be confronted with.
We're not wasting our time.
Well, that's what I'm going to say here. They're asking whose lives should be prioritized. And, Alan, we promise we're not going to spend much time on this, but I think your thoughts are really valuable. Succinctly, tell us what you're thinking.
I don't know. Sure, there's a moral dilemma. You know, I have an option to kill A or kill B. Which one do I kill? Right. If those aren't ever my only two choices, I could kill neither. Okay. Oh no, but that's the choice. Okay, whatever. You made up the problem. It's a made up problem. I need another cocktail at this cocktail party to talk about that. Da 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 da. And we'll talk about this. Come on. Plus, it's not, hey, it's probability one that we're going to kill the old guy, or probability one that we're going to kill the kid. Which one do we do? There's never a probability of one or there's a probability that we're going to do these things. So we should be multiplying the probability that we're going to do the thing by the harm that we're going to cause and decide which one it is. And okay, we find the indifference curve. Flip a coin. Then God, she gets to decide then. And then, you know, we're on with it. I don't know. I mean, these things make decisions every 30th of a second on all sorts of dimensions. And anyway, whatever. It's, you know.
And the issue is also the humans, we human drivers are sort of confronted with those same issues as well.
Well, it was, yeah, we are, and I guess we flip a coin, or I don't know what, and we aren't, I guess we aren't, you know, every once in a while, yes, the two best things to do are exactly the same. What do? We flip a coin. Okay. I don't know. I mean, I'm just, there are just so many more valuable things to spend one's time on than the trolley problem. I mean, it was invented by philosophers. And so, I mean, they just want to sit there and chit chat.
Right. The reason we bring it up probably is because when consumers look at headlines and they're thinking of autonomous vehicles this week, that's the story that they're talking about. You know, and
yeah, I guess whatever. If you don't, yes, whatever. I don't know. Good. I'm glad we've made consumers happy.
Go ahead. We had a morning program on radio this week. I think it was yesterday morning, and it was a young student of philosophy, and somehow she managed to get on the news, and she had written a paper about this. And it was the same story. And then she referred to the MIT survey. I remember looking at that survey and thinking, you know, somebody should really come into this discussion from a completely different angle. Human beings have been programmed from the time that they were able to think, maybe even before that, when we were other kinds of animals. Our DNA is based on reciprocal altruism. Everything that we do is basically programmed in our DNA. We do things for others because others are going to do things for us. That's the way we work. And if I'm going to drive my car and I've got children in the car with me, they're my children, I'm going to act differently than if I'm in that car by myself. I'm going to act differently if I'm a taxi driver with people in the car whom I do not know. There are reasons that we do things, but they're spontaneous, but they're not they're not just something that happens out of space or out of mind. They are things that are that we're programmed to do. And this whole business with the trolley problem and other philosophical discussions, they have no place in this. We're not going to be able to give robots sentience in the way that we have sentience. We have they will operate in some way that they're programmed to operate, even if it's in some way that they build this programming in themselves. And they'll find reasons, robots, I mean, will find reasons to do one thing or the other. That's not really an issue. I don't think we should even, I totally agree with Ellen on this. This isn't something that we even should be discussing, particularly not in the way that the MIT study and people have been bandying these things about. We need to get past that and say, if we're going to have robots driving cars, there needs to be responsibility. And the responsibility in the end will be humans. Robots aren't going to pay the bills. You know, companies who build robots may pay the bills, but they'll pay them based on the regulations that we set up in our countries and with insurance, with driving regulations, etc.
There's a tort system, you know, within law, and I'm not a big fan of the tort system, but the tort system really is the one that's going to deal with this. And you know, that's if you make this decisions and the decisions end up, they cause issues. The tort system goes out there and decides, okay, you have to pay this much, that much, or, you know, this is what the result is of your decisions. And so, in some sense, it goes out there and resolves these things. Based on that tort system, you know, we might decide, oh my goodness, we had programmed this thing wrong, so of course we'll change the program. Plus, you know, all these decisions that we make as individuals, as I like to say, you know, some people say, oh my goodness, you're being irrational. Bull. I'm always rational. Michael, you're always rational with your own rationality. Hey, what made somebody else's rationality the right rationality? My goodness, when did they become God? I mean, are they that much of a narcissist to say, oh, it's my way or the highway? Come on. Now, you know, we could do what maybe the MIT study was trying to do. Let's see what the collective distribution is of these various value systems and so on, and generate that distribution. And they made some sort of attempt to do that, but it was a very weak attempt. And again, those things end up changing. Oh my goodness. How did we get to the situation where we are politically in the United States? That's because, we didn't realize that, you know, people's fundamental value systems, how that distribution had changed, or distribution had changed over those that choose to go to the ballot box and pull the lever. I guess we don't pull levers anymore. Whatever. Anyway, we wasted too much time on it, Fred.
Well, that is it for this edition. Michael?
I had a cocktail this morning while we were discussing it. Now I feel better. I don't know.
Michael, thank you again for your great contributions. There's so much more in the newsletter. Where can people go to find it?
MichaelLSenna.com. One word. It's in there. I put it in.
Terrific. And it's S-E-N-A. You can find us at smartdrivingcar.com, on SoundCloud, Spreaker, Google, and iTunes, and on your Amazon Alexa. You can find my tech reports at textination.com. I'm Fred Fishkin, along with Alan Kornhauser. Thanks for listening.
Huge savings on new and previously leased furnishings. That's right, huge savings. At Court Furniture Clearance Center, choose from our wide variety of new and previously leased furniture and decor for your home or office. You'll find sofas from $199.99 and more. Everything in our 9,000 square foot showroom is Court certified, guaranteed, and in stock, ready for delivery or to take home today. Visit our Chandelier Court Furniture Clearance Center at 13946 Lee Jackson Memorial Highway, or go online at courtclearancefurniture.com. Mention Radio 20 and get 20% off.